here tonight to hear Azar Nafisi. And as most of you know, reading Lolita in Tehran has become perhaps the ideal book club reading society book. And it is that for a variety of reasons. Actually, I want to step back for a second. I forgot one thing that I should do, a little housekeeping detail. She will take questions at the end and also sign books. She'll sign the books up here, but you can purchase the books from our friends and partners who are responsible for bringing Azar Nafisi to us, Rainy Day Books. And we thank them, as always. They've been one of our greatest partners. And you can buy the books if you don't already have them just around the corner here. But Ms. Nafisi will sign them up here. And then the other thing I also want to tell you is, in addition to Rainy Day, tonight our co-sponsor is the International Relations Council, and we thank them for being here. Their literature is out here. We partner with them in a number of things and have plans to partner with them in a lot more. They, like the library, are the city's portal to the world, and I think that is important. And Azar Nafisi is also a portal to the world, to a world that most of us don't know anything about. In Iran, Tehran, her father, the mayor of Tehran, and reading Lolita in Tehran, of course, is one of the best books I've ever read, one of the greatest books ever written about the transcendence of local culture, the transcendence of literature, the transcendence of books and ideas as human nature comes into to contact with that. She has a wonderful line, I think, quoting from Nabokov, and of course you know that Nabokov is one of her favorite authors, talking about the rent in this world leading to another world of tenderness, brightness, and beauty. It's what literature does for us. It's what her book, Reading Lolita in Tehran, has done for us. It's what her new book that she'll be talking about, Things I've Been Silent About, does through a different medium, the medium of the story of her family. For those of you who've read Reading Lolita, you know that she has an encounter with a magician that is a focal point of the book, and she tells this story, and we don't really know if the magician is real or not, as her fantasy or as a real encounter she had. But I think the one thing that we do know about her writing is that she has become our magician, magician of books and ideas and of the transcendence of cultures through literature. So it's a real honor for the Kansas City Public Library to welcome Azar Nafisi.
Thank you so much. It is such a privilege to be here. Thank you so much. You know, I felt so terrible when I became ill and I couldn't come last time. But hearing Crosby talk, I thought, well, I don't think that any of us would be wanting to be so ungenerous to me to wish me to be ill in a way so that he could go on with his ode to an, you know. But I tell you, I would have loved to listen to him. And one of the signs that makes me always feel at home in a place is the way the conversations go. And just before coming here, having conversations with the wonderful owners of Rainy Day Bookstore, Vivian and Jeff, and my great colleague, wherever she is, Bridget from Random House, you know, I felt that in D.C., I was reminded of the fact that coming from D.C., you know, how people in D.C. love to drop names, you know. Oh, yes, today I just ran into Michelle, and yes, what kind of a dress are you going to be wearing for such and such? Well, I drop names of the bookstores I've been to, you know. I say things like, yes, I was just, you know, talking to so-and-so about the book passages and on my way to Elliott Bay, and then there was Books and Books on the way, and there was Schwartz in Milwaukee while I was just going to Brookline Bookstore, and yes, yes, Rainy Day is in my agenda, of course, definitely, you know. And you know, that is how I show off, and that is the place where I feel most at home with. And right right side by side, of course, is a place like this, is libraries. When you come to a place like this, you are reminded that one of the best things about books is the connections they make. You know, they connect you to people whom you should be connected to, not to people who are whom you have to see or meet every day because of where you were born or because what you do or because fate or gods put you in a place, but people who genuinely share the same passions and the same dreams as you do. And you feel far less lonely in this world that can be depriving you of everything that you have at the drop of an eye. And I constantly think whenever I come to a place like this, I think that this is the place, this is a communal space where strangers immediately become intimate strangers. This is the magic of books. Books are like your children. You know, you go through so much labor and anxiety, and they better be a labor of love. But once they come into this world, you don't know what amazing, wonderful places they take you to and what intimate strangers they bring to your home. Because this relationship between readers and writers is always a relationship where you become immediately intimate with a stranger that you have never met, that you have never talked about. And it is in this republic of imagination where your passport, your identity card, is never your nationality, your ethnicity, your race, your class, your gender, your religion. What gives you permission to enter this republic of imagination is simply your passion and your curiosity. Nabokov used to tell his students, curiosity is insubordination in its purest form. And you know, in these political and politicized days that we live in these politicized times that we live in, it is important to remember that insubordination does not mean every once in a while going in front of the White House and self-righteously, you know, putting your political positions out there, or every 4 years voting. Insubordination means constantly questioning the world, and in questioning the world, questioning yourself. And I think this is what the books do. They force each one of us, both as writers and as readers, to pose ourselves as question marks, to never become smug, to never be completely at home in our own home. There is another great thinker, Theodor Adorno, who used to say, the highest form of morality is not to feel at home in your own home. And I think that this is what great works of imagination do. And you know, when you came to this place today, did anybody at the door ask you, are you a Republican or a Democrat? Did they ask you, are you a conservative or a liberal, before they let you in? Because we do need a space. We do need a space where we will all share our common humanity, where we will all understand that we, each and every individual in this world, shares the best and the worst. And so I have decided that every time that I talk about my books, I will not just talk about that particular book, but I will also put it within the context of celebrating books. Because where would my books be? Where would I be as a writer if readers, if libraries, if bookstores, if colleges and universities, if community of millions of people in the world did not want to read books, and through reading books, they did not resurrect the book through different eyes, through different times. And like what so many people, so many elite in our academics tell us, books is not, we don't write because we want to just write about ourselves. And we don't read because we want to reaffirm what we already know. I mean, how bloody boring to be constantly thinking about yourself. Writing is always about the other. Even when you write about yourself, You are investigating that stranger within you that constantly pops out and unexpectedly surprises you. Margaret Atwood was asked, how does she begin to write? And she said, you know, it seems as if there are voices from distant villages beckoning to me. It seems as if there is a bloody cleaver in the middle of the living room, and I ask myself, what is that bloody cleaver doing there? It needs to be investigated. You know, and so for me, both the act of writing and the act of reading is always an investigation. It is always about knowledge, not the kind of knowledge we hear about nowadays, not the kind of science and imagination that it is merely reduced to technology and to technique, but the kind of knowledge that always, always is after changing not just the world, but itself. And it is only through this genuine curiosity, this almost sensual knowledge, desire for knowledge, this sensual urge for knowing, that we gain empathy, that we connect to those who are not like us. That, as the narrator in To Kill a Mockingbird once said, you will not be able to know any other person unless you put on their shoes and walk around in them for a while. So no amount of political correctness, no amount of edicts and laws can do for us what imagination and thought does. Because when all is said and done, every single story that you read is simultaneously about difference, about uniqueness of not just people who come from other cultures or other nations, but about the uniqueness of each individual. And it is a celebration of that uniqueness. But simultaneously, and that is where the shock of recognition comes. The shock of recognition comes out of the fact of how alike we are. That if a mother in Baghdad wakes up in the morning and her house is gone and her children are dead, or a woman in Darfur who has been raped time and time again and her children have been murdered in front of her eyes, or a woman in Afghanistan who has been taken to a football stadium and a gun put to her head and executed because she does not act according to the mandatory codes of dressing, or a woman in one of the most poetic cities in this very country, a woman from New Orleans, whose life is destroyed not by a revolution or a war, but just by an act of nature. And one morning she wakes up and everything that she called home is gone forever. Or the crisis that we are right now experiencing in this great country, and all the people who see everything that they defined themselves by is you know, fading in front of their eyes. When we think of all these different people, we realize that the bard was right. If you prick us, we all bleed. And because we all bleed, we have this common space, and this common space is by coming to a place like this, where a woman named Emily Dickinson lives side by side with a man named Ralph Ellison, with a man named Hafez, with a woman named Jane Austen, with a man named Rumi. And you know, they come throughout the ages and they speak to us as if they are our contemporaries. So what I thought I'll do today is, you know, not read much from my book. I might read, you know, one or two passages. I always think that readers at least should be given a chance, if they like the book, they'll borrow it from the library or go right now to Rainy Books and buy the book, you know. And if they don't, then they don't, you know, no matter how much I read to them, they're not going to be convinced that they should go and buy my book, you know. So rather than doing that, I thought that what I will do tonight is tell you the story behind the story, that why I came to write this book at this moment in my life, because every book has a birth certificate, which is partly rooted in the reality where the book is conceived, and at the same time it has its heritage in other books. It has sort of a literary birth certificate as well, and I thought that I'll talk about that birth certificate, because in this book I wanted to examine and investigate the relationship between what is historical and political and social to what is both simultaneously individual as well as universal. And I didn't want this to be... I told my publisher, and I really appreciate the fact that they went along with me and they welcomed this, I told them, this is not going to be a sensational book where people would say, okay, let's see now, you know, what... I did not want to have people be nosy about my book. I wanted them to be curious. And I told them that I don't want this to be an aspirin. How to treat your mother once you read this book, you reach closure and, you know, move on with life, you know. No, no, books are not aspirin. Books are not how to live. Books. Books give us an experience, and books show us that pain and anguish, like joy and happiness and comfort, should be confronted, that they're part of life. So I did not want to lessen the pain by telling you how I reached closure, and I told them that this is not reading Lolita Part 2, you know, the return of reading Lolita, you know, or reading Lolita in Tehran via Washington, D.C., you know, I wanted this book to have its own character and breathe its own air and find its own intimate strangers. But the book, despite what I'm telling you, it does have two other siblings. There were two other books I wrote before I wrote this one, and it comes partly out of my reactions, you know, to the writing of those books. When I was writing my first book on Vladimir Nabokov in the Islamic Republic of Iran in late 1980s and early 1990s, did not want to pontificate as a literary theorist, although we have some fantastic literary theorists who know how not to pontificate, but I wanted to write about the different realities under which I read Vladimir Nabokov's books and how that reality changed my interpretation of those books and how the reading of those books changed my interpretation of reality. But the first problem that I faced was that living where I lived, I could not write about those realities, you know, honestly and truthfully. And it was not just about the political repression and political and social matters that I could not talk about. I could not talk about the personal, because at the time the personal was confiscated and it had gone underground. So I could not simply say, for example, that the first book I read by Vladimir Nabokov was Ada. It was given to me by my boyfriend Ted, who wrote on the flyleaf, "To Azar, my Ada, love, Ted." And I and my family, we are a nation of diary writers. This is what we do all our lives. I still have with me the first pages of the diary I wrote at the age of 12. And I love to give titles and names to some parts of my diaries. So I wrote under a segment, I wrote things I've been silent about. And I wrote about political executions and the social situation, but I also wrote about the absurdity of my situation in Tehran. I wrote things like falling in love in Tehran, watching Marx Brothers in Tehran, reading Jane Austen in Tehran, and of course reading Lolita in Tehran. And then I later realized that all through my diaries, there has been an underlying theme, an unfinished and an ongoing story, which was about my personal life, which was something that I had been silent about and I had kept silent about. So reading Lolita in Tehran was partly a reaction to the silences that were imposed on me when I went back to Iran in 1979 and when a system had now come to power and every authoritarian system implements its power and tries to legitimize itself by silencing voices. Because what they are scared of, all totalitarian mindsets, and not just political systems, mindsets are of different voices. They want to impose one voice and one image upon every voice and every image. That is how they control. And that is why in the Islamic Republic after 1979, the main targets became women and minorities and culture. And so the whole idea when I came back to the United States was partly I wanted to talk. And in this book, I talk about how my mother, every time I did not leave Iran until 1990. And every time I left Iran to go abroad for a conference, my mother would come and tell me, tell them. And you know, by tell them, she meant tell them how we live. Because always when your voice is taken away from you, it is so important and crucial to your existence to know that other people know about you. The whole idea of writing stories is to partly retrieve the voice and the identity that you cannot have in reality or the kind of reality that you cannot control. But one thing happened, and both this book and that book, because of the place I lived in, I'm sure it was also a reaction to where I lived, and that was when I came to this country. I realized that although I was very free to express everything that I wanted, the image of my country, of my culture, the image of my grandmother and my mother and myself and my daughter was so reduced. It was so politicized and polarized that people knew you only through knowing bits and pieces about the present-day political Iran. That what they knew, whenever you think of Iran, you certainly do not think of these beautiful, wonderful young women who are walking down the streets defying all the laws, you know, looking like, models coming from the Mars, you know, so gorgeous they look, you know, defying every single law that the land has imposed on them. You do not think of a bunch of girls sitting in a room eating cream puffs and reading Lolita, do you? What comes to your mind is the image of our president, Mr. Ahmadinejad, who has usually a smirk on his face as if he has broken the neighbor's window and gotten away with it, you know. And every single media network in this country zooms on him, on what he says. When you listen to Iran, about Iran, you hear about WMDs. You know, you hear about terror, but the 70 million people who come from different cultures, who come from different backgrounds, different ethnicities, the majority who are Muslim come from a variety backgrounds. Those we don't see. When I would talk about the things that I wanted to talk about, they would look at me and they say, oh, you're Western. You know, as if the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness is an American thing. You know, if you live in Iran or in Afghanistan, you just don't want to be happy. You know, as a woman, you say, well, no. I mean, if you think that I want to pursue happiness, you must be mistaking me for some American feminist. You know, no. I'm no Iranian woman. It's not within our culture to love choice. No. I really like to be married at the age of 9. You know, that is my genuine culture. You know, that is how else can I interpret these people? And in this book, in my new book, I talk about a person who was my mother's cousin. She was one of the first women who went abroad to Europe. And when she came back, rather than getting married as the tradition was, she went to work. And some people would tell my mother, look, if you do with this child what you're doing, letting her continue her education, she'll be like this woman. Don't let her become, an old maid marrying at the age of 42. And I never thought, what was wrong with this old maid? I could never figure out. But that woman used to tell my mother, tell this child that what she can do now is because of all the things that women in this country did before her. So I wanted the background, I wanted the context to this book, be how my grandmother and at the beginning of 20th century and my mother and I lived in this country, which was so paradoxical, in a country that at the beginning of 20th century had a constitutional revolution against absolutist monarchy and absolutist cleric, or religious orthodoxy, in which women and intellectuals and progressive clerics and various strata of Iranians participated. And Iranian women at that time were so progressive that an American called Morgan Schuster, in a book he wrote in 1912, Strangling of Persia, which I mention in this book, says that Iranian women at Bound have made leaps of centuries. He compares them to Western women and says that they have made far more progress. And he says that if this, seems like a fable, it is the truth. So by the time of the Islamic Revolution, we had women in all walks of life. Shirin Ebadi, the Nobel Peace Laureate, was one of the first women circuit judges in Tehran. During the revolution, she was defrocked because they said women are too weak to judge, but she didn't go home. Women like her did not go home. They became lawyers for women and children, and women like my mother, would constantly tell the stories of how they fought in order to move forward. And when I myself came to America, and I read about Sojourner Truth or Elizabeth Cady Stanton or Susan B. Anthony, when I read that Susan B. Anthony, that Elizabeth Cady Stanton did not live to see American women gain their right to vote, when I discovered how British women until late 19th century did not have the right to their property, in the parliament there was a place for women where ladies would be heard but not would be seen but not heard, because women were not supposed to talk in public. When I looked at the history of this country, and I discovered that in the 70s, when I was in this country, if Hillary Clinton was going to run for president, many people would call her a bra-burning, lunatic feminist. Never mind the fact that Barack Obama could not gain entrance to so many restaurants and public places. And now, we were told that Bible tells us that women's place is at home and slavery is okay. Now we have not only Hillary Clinton running for president, but because of the struggle of women to change those traditions, now we have Sarah Palin as well. This is important. This is very important because, you see, women have moved to a place where now you judge them not based on the fact that they're women, but based on the fact whether you agree with their agenda or not. But you have a conservative woman who in the 70s and 60s would have been opposing Hillary Clinton, would be standing on the sidewalks telling her, why are you protesting, who now has a first dude. I mean, this is very important. I think Gloria Steinem should be very happy. But that is not all. I'm not going to be singing the praises of Barack Obama because everyone else is. And I was telling Jeff that I'm sick and tired of books that are banking on Obama. They banked on Bush in one way, and they're now banking on Obama another way. But Obama or Palin or Hillary Clinton are not merely causes of change. They are symptoms of change. They are symptoms of what we did during the time of abolition, what we have been doing for over a century. Now, you have a man who not is only an African-American who is the president of this country. You have a man called Barack Hussein Obama, Hussein. How many Husseins in the world now think that they do not have to be terrorists, but they can become presidents? How would their view of this country change? But not only that, you have a Hussein whose father was a Muslim who refused religion, whose mother was a liberal Christian who really didn't pay much attention to religion, who himself chose to be a Christian and keep the name Hussein. Now, who is Christian and who is Muslim? How many Alis and Husseins can now become Jews or Christians or Baha'is or Zoroastrian? This is how cultures allow themselves to change. No culture can be determined merely by traditions that are restrictive. The traditions we keep are the traditions of Lincoln. You mentioned Mark Twain, the traditions of Twain, the traditions of Zora Neale Hurston. These are the traditions that are still alive, but the dead ones should be dead where they belong. And it doesn't matter whether you're a Muslim or an atheist or a communist or a Christian. Now, when we talk, I'm sorry, you should cough more often and I will finish. Crosby, how long more can I speak? Because I haven't come to my book yet. And this is... I'm sorry. It's your fault. If you stop laughing, I would... I will try to finish because pretty soon you'll be leaving. I mean, it's so lovely to talk about democracy, but once you have the podium, you know, you all of a sudden, you know, don't encourage me. But anyway, these are all related to this book because these are the points that... Not in this way, but this is the story behind the story in this book. Because as I was going through the history of my own country, I came to two parallels, and this is simplifying it. I came to two parallel stories. One is a story like any other country of brutality, of totalitarianism, of repression. I mean, when we talk about confiscating a culture, we're talking about when the Islamic Republic came to this country, they changed the age of marriage from 18 to 9. You know, they brought the punishment of stoning to death. For what they call prostitution and adultery. I talk about it in this book, about how my former school principal, Dr. Parsai, who was an educated woman with my mother, she was one of the first women who went into the Iranian parliament in 1963 and later became minister for education. After the revolution, after a summary trial, she was accused of prostitution, warring with God. And supporting the imperialists, and no one knows how she was really killed. Some say that she was put in a sack because she was a woman, and bullets were shot through the sack until she was dead. Some say she was hanged. Some say she was stoned. But for me, that image of my old school principal, whom I used to make so much fun of when I was a kid, whom I really disliked because she was so serious-minded and such a disciplinarian, you know, comes back to me. And every time I talk, I have to remind myself of the kind of women who made it possible for someone like me to be talking the way I do. But what I'm trying to say is that if this is my culture, if this is my religion, if this is my tradition, then burning witches in Europe and Inquisition and fascism and Stalinism that came out of the heart of the most civilized countries in Europe is the culture of Europe, and not St. Thomas Aquinas or St. Augustine or Goethe or Dante or Emily Bronte. If this is my culture, then slavery is the culture of this country, and not Flannery O'Connor or Faulkner or Hemingway or Toni Morrison. Because every culture has something to be ashamed of. Every culture. There are no innocents in this world. This crazy nationalism that both people in my country and in my new country here are caught by is just simply crazy. We're all implicated. But the fact that cultures change, that people have the courage to say no, That is also a parallel story. And that parallel story of the way we can resist not just political reality, but reality itself, because reality is transient. And we are constantly, some of the best poets in Iran constantly talk about the transience and fickleness of life. And the only thing you have against this fickleness, against the absoluteness of death, against the oblivion that death and life impose on us, is the conclusive evidence that we have lived, which is stories, which is imagination, which is art. That is all we have. You know, and so the parallel story, which becomes part of my personal story in this book, is what my father used to tell me. He used to tell me that we live in an ancient country. Iran goes at least to 2,500 years, half of which was Zoroastrian. And you know, we still have the Zoroastrian rites very much alive in our country. We still, our new year is based on the Zoroastrian rite of the spring, on the 21st of March. The names of months in Iranian calendar are based on the ancient Persian deities. I was born in December, which is the month of Azar, which is the deity for fire. So my father used to say, this country has been constantly attacked and its rights usurped. It has been ruled by tyrants. But there is one thing that keeps the identity of this country intact. There is one thing that we can go back to, and that is the works of its poets. When you have a poet like Ferdowsi, about whom my father used to talk to me when I was about 3 or 4 years old, I talk about it in this book, how later he wrote a book on Ferdowsi and some of our other poets based on the stories he told my brother and I. You know, when I think of a poet like Ferdowsi living 1,000 years ago, and yet when you read the stories in Ferdowsi, it has been marvelously translated by one of the best translators and poets in English language, Dick Davies. When you read that, the sensuality, the eroticism, the colorfulness, the variety, the self-critical eye of the characters in this book of epics about ancient Persia, that is what takes you. When you read the Persian poet Hafiz, who 750 years ago said hypocritical clerics who drink wine in private and flog people in public, the agnostic poet Khayyam, who was immortalized by Fitzgerald, or Sa'di, who Emerson was in love with and translated. When you read these people, then the parallel story of Iran comes into life. And in this book, I wanted it to be both a criticism of the country I was born into and of the parents that gave birth to me and of myself, and simultaneously a celebration of the country that I loved, of the parents that I loved, and of myself, and how I was implicated in everything that I myself criticized. So to make this very long story very short, I'm now coming to the end of my talk on this book, and I want to say a few things about living here in America. So things I have been silent about, I was not going to write this book. When I finished reading Lolita in Tehran, I was going to write a book called The Republic of Imagination. But as I was writing acknowledgments to reading Lolita in Tehran, my mother died on January 2nd, 2003. She was a very difficult woman with whom all my life I had problems, and I've discovered since then that this is a very universal, actually, problem. It is not mine. Terrible. I mean, you write a book and everybody else comes and says, oh, yes, you know, I had the same problems. The truth is that, yes, we all, it is good to know that so many other people actually had these problems, that I was not singled out for this. She was very intrusive. I talk in this book about how she wanted to mold us, to shape me according to her image. She would write read my letters, my diaries, listen on my, to my phone calls, and then blame me for what I had said in private and would never accept that, that you know, she was wrong. And she claimed that from the moment I was born, I resisted her. She said, you refuse to be breastfed just to be nasty towards me. She would tell me, you come from the same rotten genes. She meant my father. Now, the fact that they were both related, they were both belong to the Nafisi clan, was another. So those rotten genes become very suspicious. But the whole idea was that all my life, I craved her approval and her love. And all my life, I resented and resisted her. And suddenly she was gone. You know, suddenly I felt there is an unfinished conversation here that I need to tend to. When your parents die, that absoluteness of death, that most horrifying and awesome of all silences, all of a sudden overshadows every other silence. And you realize that to combat that absence, you realize that that absence is what becomes central to everything that is present in your life. And I wanted this book to be a celebration and a mourning at the same time. I wanted it to be a celebration of memory, because without memory, we will not have conclusive evidence that we have lived. And because throughout writing this book, I remembered how my mother, I had a mother who wanted me to be something, who gave me all she had despite everything that she did to me. But she herself, the only thing she remembered of her mother was the night her mother died. She was so young, she could not remember anything about her mother's life, about the touch of her mother on her skin, even about her mother scolding her and telling her, you belong to the same rotten genes. So she started her life with an absence. She had nothing to lose. And it is terrible not to have anything to lose. And so, and then I talk in the book how she married a man who was the prime minister's son at this time, gorgeous, handsome, in love with her. And on their wedding night, she discovered that he had a fatal disease that they had not told her, because the doctor had said, let him live out the remaining years happy. And they decided that they should marry without her knowledge. So she nursed him to death. So a person without memory, a person whose experience of life is the bitterness of absence, a woman so intelligent in her own time, being always the top of her class, she constantly said, if I were a man. And her best friend used to say, another intelligent woman gone to waste, like Alice Sebald's Almost Moon. Those women who have all the potentials, but they never become full moon because they're not allowed to blossom. So I understood her better. And I understood her loneliness. And I understood her bitterness. And I understood the fact that she resented me because she never had a mother and I had one. So she resented me for having her. And my father, who was one of the best, I mean, I never loved anyone the way I loved my father. He was the one who started me with stories. He was the one who would play games with stories. We would invent our relationship through the stories we told ourselves. One of the gentlest and most courageous public men I have ever met. In their private life, his illusion was that this marriage that really did not work, he wanted to make it work. So he wanted this lie to become the truth. And so at first he would try to comply with her, and then he would lie to her. And because I was the closest person to him, I became complicit in the lies that he told her. And we justified ourselves by lying to her, by saying that she was too dictatorial. But we didn't understand that the act of lying would make everyone complicit, whether you want it or not. So this book, as I mentioned in the prologue, is also a response to the worst censor we face in our lives, not the outer censor, not the blind censor I talk in Lolita, but our own inner censor and inquisitor. I wanted to write not just about how I was ashamed of the world I'd lived in, but how there were moments in my life where I became complicit and I was ashamed of what I did or where I went or how I acted. So this is what the book is all about. And at the end of the book, One thing that I realize now, as I realized in reading Lolita, is that I wouldn't talk about it. I just would like to just read a paragraph at the end of my book about what my parents gave me. I refer at the end of the book to an incident when I was 4 years old, and my mother wanted always my bed to be by the wall, and I wanted my bed to be by the windowsill. There was a ledge there, and I loved to have my bed by the window, but every night she moved the bed to where she wanted. And one night I come home, and I started crying, and I went to bed without eating food, and my father came in the morning with a plate of chocolates, and he told me, let's you and I start something, a new game, and it was a game of inventing stories. So I want to end this part about my parents where I think it is both a declaration of independence and a paying of a homage to them. You cannot be independent without paying your homage. I want to end about this book with this paragraph. In my first real confrontation with my mother, so many decades ago, when at the age of 4, I instinctively and with some desperation realized that I did not even have the power to move my bed to my favorite spot in my room, my father taught me to regain control by traveling to that other world no one could take away from me. After the Islamic Revolution, I came to realize the fragility of our mundane existence, the ease with which all that you call home, all that gives you an identity, a sense of self and belonging, can be taken away from you. I learned that what my father had given me through his stories was a way to make a home for myself that was not dependent on geography or nationality or anything that other people can take away from me. These stories could not guard me against the pain I felt at my parents' loss. They did not offer consolation or closure. I'm going to write a whole book against the word closure. It was only after their death that I came to realize that they each, in their own way, had given me a portable home that safeguards memory and is a constant resistance against the tyranny of man and of time. So this is how this story ends. It's a personal story set in a historical time. I just want to end with a note about this other story that I'm thinking about. On December 1st, 2008, I finally became an American citizen. And I thought that, well, thank you. I will tell you why I'm saying this and why I'm ending with this and not on myself or my parents. I think that in a time of crisis, this is a good time to share a country's faith, because this is the time also that is the time for hope and for change. And that is what we need today. But in this country that I love so much, as I love my other home, I kept thinking, what gift can I bring from that other home to this country? This was a country that my children and myself were taught was based on a poetic vision. When I read, in order to become a full citizen, when I would read about the founding fathers, I would realize the wisdom of people who had the poetry and the knowledge of their age so imbued in them that they could write a constitution and a declaration of independence that went beyond their own limitations. That the descendant of a Lincoln would be a Barack Obama. This was the kind of country that I thought I will come to. I came to this country, and I see that as well. I see it in the people who are here tonight. But I also see that those very men who left us cheated, who left so many of us bankrupt, have become models for everything that you know I held dear. This is the time when everyone, including Saks Fifth Avenue, is asking for a bailout. I think the question we need to put to ourselves is, who is going to bail out imagination and thought? When I was in Philadelphia, 11 libraries were closing down. In Boston, out of 14 bookstores in Harvard Square, only 2 remained. Everywhere I go, our liberal arts colleges and our humanities are closing down. our college presidents come from the business world with no love of knowledge or our academia. Our congressmen say that art is just for the left liberal elite and that they are speaking on the behalf of workers. How condescending to workers and common men to think that workers and people like you and me do not like art, do not frequent museums, do not go to libraries. It is the family of the poorest of the poor who need the libraries, who bring their children here not only to use books but to use them after school. So these are the questions that are facing us today. One of the greatest of American writers in 20th century, Saul Bellow, said that in a country like the Soviet Union, in the East, cruelty and brutality is obvious and naked. That sort of repression, that sort of death, we react to immediately. But he said what threatens us in the West, in democracies, is our sleeping consciousness. He said the danger is atrophy of feeling. Those men who told our children to just go into plain economics and literature and philosophy and history were for the geeks, that you could not do anything with, those men are the ones who are bankrupt today. Even our robber barons, at some point, our robber barons, men like Carnegie, like Whitney, like Mellon, like Rockefeller, they took and they stole, but they knew how to give back. This was a country that made itself, that created its infrastructure through universities, through libraries, through a celebration, an instinctive celebration of the act of knowledge. Our publishers are going bankrupt. Our writers cannot write. What are we going to do about it? We cannot ask Bush or Obama to respond to everything that we need. We are responsible. We are implicated in where we stand today. It cannot be greed, but it is passion. It is passion that has been the guiding principle of a country like this. And if we do not bring passion into profit, I don't think we will solve any problem. So what I hope we will create a national conversation through places like this about what are we going to be doing? Will we have townhouse meetings in our libraries and bookstores and in the streets and in our universities talking about what are we as communities going to be doing about this? And I hope, and I genuinely hope, that the next march on Washington, and I hope there will be a next march on Washington, it will not be in protest, but it will be for the creation of that national conversation. I want to end by reminding you that one of the questions in the citizenship test is, what are the first words of the Constitution? And as I was reading the response to that question and remembering that it is we the people, I thought that I don't want to go to the elite, even those I agree with, that where I need to go is to come to people like you, to we the people, and tell you that people like me come to this country not to just make money. We come to this country in order to be free to imagine and free to think. And so I want to end with a slogan, because I hate slogans, and I want to say, readers of the world, unite. Thank you.